talks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals. Good morning. This is Talking Animals. Happy New Year. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is William Nimmo, founder of Tigers in America. His multifaceted mission is rooted in the disturbing statistic that there are more than 5,000 tigers in the U.S., more than exist in the wild in the rest of the world. Toward that end, Tigers in America seeks to, among other tasks, identify the best tiger sanctuaries in this country, support their rescues of unwanted or abused tigers, and help them construct new enclosures to take in additional tigers. We'll find out more about this and the whole nefarious business of captive-bred tigers when we speak with William Nimmo in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also, later in the show, we'll speak briefly with Gracie Grishup of Pet Pal Animal Shelter about the PIT Project, their program to carefully educate people about pit bulls in the hope this yields additional adoptions of the dogs. Also, a few quick programming notes. First, many thanks to Bev Capshaw, who sat in for me last week and delivered a fabulous edition of Talking Animals. Also, 2 weeks from today, Talking Animals begins airing at 10 a.m., an hour later than our present broadcast time. So 10 a.m. starting on January 21st and each Wednesday thereafter. Meanwhile, later today, I'll be filling in for Scott Elliott on the All Souls edition of It's the Music from 1 to 4 p.m., presenting songs galore, few if any animal songs, but assorted other songs indeed. Right now, for our opening animal song this morning, in a nod to our imminent chat with Bill Nimmo, I thought we should do something tiger-related. This is Stephen Malkmuth and the Jicks. With tigers now, on Talking Animals.
I caught you streaking in your Birkenstocks, a scary thought in the 2Ks. It's not too late, since the toothpaste got enveloped in your sticker shock. I gotta tell ya, it's a barrage, it's a barrage, it's a mirage.
We are the tigers, we need sand.
Stephen Malkmuth and the Jicks with Tigers, a peppy animal song, Tiger Tune, no less, to get us launched this morning. Let's move now into our conversation with William Nimmo about his organization, Tigers in America, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@wmnf.org, or texting us at 813-433-0885. Let's welcome William Nimmo to Talking Animals. Good morning, Bill.
Hello, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals this morning.
Happy to do it.
So there are a number of things that are distinctive about Tigers in America, and I look forward to exploring many of them with you in a moment, but I feel a critical part of what separates Tigers in America may be your own story. Talk, if you will, a little bit about your career in the pre-Tigers in America era.
Oh, before Tigers, BC?
Yeah, that's right.
My wife and I really didn't know too much about the Tigers. We live in New York City, work in New York City, and we're pretty much in banking and brokerage. And we just became aware of what we call the captive bred tiger problem. Interestingly enough, around the anniversary of 9/11 in 2011, when we found out about the sanctuary in Texas that had gone bankrupt and they had a problem placing tigers. It sounds a little strange to us, number one, that there were giant sanctuaries with exotic animals, and number two, that they were full of tigers. And unfortunately, as we learned to find out, that the tigers, of all of the exotic animals, are the most difficult to place because of their size and their vet requirements and their enclosures and, you know, what you need to do to take proper care of a tiger. We just found out about it sort of by accident by a couple phone calls.
But, yeah, so that begs, raises kind of an important question right off the bat, which is how do people that are otherwise in banking and the brokerage end of things find out about this and then act on it? What did you guys have a longstanding interest in either animals generally or tigers more specifically, and that this information about the sanctuary in Texas served as a catalyst? Or, I mean, how did you get from point A to point B?
It was sort of opportunistic, perhaps. In the 90s, middle 90s, we knew these people in southern New Jersey that actually had a few tigers on their property, friends of friends, and we used to go visit them. And just being around the tigers was sort of fascinating. In the 90s, there was very, very desolate in that part of New Jersey, and they had set up a compound, and they began to care for tigers. And we actually went down and saw them, but our careers progressed and, you know, sort of work got in the way and we lost track of them in maybe 95, 96. And strangely enough, 15 years later, we had gotten a call saying that this facility in New Jersey had their tigers taken away from them by the state and transported to Wild Animal Orphanage, which is the sanctuary in San Antonio, Texas. And then, which sounded like a good idea, but then when we found out that the San Antonio place was filed for bankruptcy and then the tigers were sort of at risk again, that's what drew us into it.
Yeah. I'd still be interested to know, though, that if I'm not mistaken, I think your background includes working at Smith Barney and I think a senior vice president at Citigroup. Why did someone place that call to you or you and your wife and say, hey, there's trouble in Texas with this sanctuary closing? I still just feel like there's a leap there of that's interesting, but I'm just trying to sort out how that worked.
It was friends of friends, and I guess the request came in about whether or not we knew about it, because a small circle of friends knew that we had sort of a passing interest in the big cats and specifically tigers. And that it was an unsolicited call that came in and they said, did you know, Bill, that those tigers in New Jersey aren't there anymore? And we didn't understand why. Mm. I mean, if you have, and at that point, that facility had 12 acres of land and, plenty of food for the animals. And we just didn't know why it went bad or it ceased to exist. that began the investigation of what the hell happened, and that led to there's a problem in San Antonio. And I guess I could have left it at that, Duncan, but, I mean, it just sounds strange to us, you know?
So it piqued your curiosity, obviously. I mean, you didn't just get this call and say, oh, well, that's interesting or that's unusual. It obviously kind of was an inciting incident of some kind.
Yeah, and if the call came in, and we're members of the Humane Society and other places like that, and if a call came in and it had to do with bears, maybe, or... you know, elephants, we probably wouldn't have the interest that we have now because, we did have some sort of experience with tigers in New Jersey. So that's pretty much what drove the interest, and it's what put me on a plane to San Antonio.
So once you got on that plane, then what happened?
Well, I went there and with the help and the help and guidance of Patty Finch from G-Fast and Carol Baskin from Big Cat Rescue, because this is all new to us, but we were trying to find out whether or not those tigers that were in New Jersey that were transferred there actually were still alive, because it's been 15 years and we didn't know how long tigers lived. And so we went down there and were provided access to the people that were remaining. There were very, very short staff down there because it was bankrupt. And they showed us the tigers in the back, and they said these are the ones that came from New Jersey. And through sort of an elaborate process of stripe matching, because pretty much, you probably know this, in tiger world or in big cat world, the registration of these animals is not, it's not that accurate or dependable. So really the only way you can know whether or not the tiger's identity is real is to actually match the stripes. So my wife had pictures of the tigers. At that point, they were cubs in New Jersey, and matched those against the pictures that WAO sent us. And in fact, the seven of those tigers were identified as tigers from New Jersey. So, so I spoke to a lawyer who spoke to the judge in the bankruptcy court and asked for release of them, and they granted that. And so we made arrangements to take those seven out and put three of them in Big Cat Rescue and in Tampa, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Your neighbor.
Right.
Great place.
Yeah.
And four went to Carolina Tiger Rescue. And that was sort of the beginning step of, trying to help out a couple big cats. We didn't know the problem was much, much larger than that. We just thought it was sort of a one-off, a strange coincidence.
Right. And again, it sounds like that what prompted you to act in some regards is that there was this link, or at least ostensibly this link, to the tigers that you knew from those friends in New Jersey. So
that's
you were
correct.
Sort of following that trail, amongst other things. Once those seven tigers had been placed, and then you realized kind of the scope of the situation, what happened then? When did you decide, hey, this isn't just a one-shot deal where we'll scoot down to San Antonio and help these tigers? Maybe we need to do something on a broader, more ongoing basis.
Yeah, well, during the calling around process, Duncan, where you're trying to figure out who knows what, you do... I don't want to say make friends, but you do contact people in these animal welfare organizations and you tell them what your interest is, and, they sort of help you out. They're very, very gracious. And we thought that was sort of the end of that transaction, and it was sort of bizarre, but, a happy ending for seven tigers. And then we started to get a call, or calls, plural. So then somebody called up, I think it was GFAS, called up and said, there's this place in Ohio, and the lady's got nine tigers and actually lions, and she's having trouble, and it looks like they're going to close down, and could you help? And then we said, okay, and then I went to Ohio, and then Ohio led to Indiana, which led to Missouri, and then I realized that, it's a constant, right? San Antonio wasn't some bizarre one-off thing. There's a problem out there, and we didn't know the size and scope of it, but as the calls came in and as we went out to help, we realized that there's something going on out here that we just don't understand.
As you quickly became the go-to guy or guy and gal for tiger situations, and you realize this, let's really talk about that problem. I mean, how big is the captive tiger problem in the U.S.? I mean, you routinely hear that there are some 5,000 tigers in captivity in this country, and that's way more than are anywhere in the wild. But it's hard not to think that the actual figure is a good deal larger than that. What's your sense of that now?
Because we live in the city and because we have access to research, we got the help from a lot of people, and we began to ask that specific question. You know, how many tigers are there, and where the hell are they? And then we got the results back, and you know, it's the places you would predict that the AZA zoos have about 300, not about, they have 360 tigers. They have a species survival program, and then they have some generics. I don't want to get too geeky on you, but there's roadside zoos they have about 2,000. There's what we call phony sanctuaries for 2,500. Circuses and theme parks for 100. Animal actors, those are the people that provide the tigers for, you know, TVs and commercials and stuff like that. A good number of private owners, which was a surprise to us. And then what we call the real sanctuaries, the sanctuaries that care for the tigers for their entire lives. And they have about 400. So you add up those seven categories and you get 7,000 tigers. That's the number we use, and that's the number we're pretty confident with. We think it's a low-end number. And it's not that we're just focused on tigers. It's just that that seems to be the most abused of all of the big cats. And if you wanted to know, and when we're asked the question, well, how many big cats are there out there? You know, if you include the lions, leopards, cougars, cheetahs, and jaguars, then the best rule of thumb is to just double that number.
Wow.
So in terms of big cats in the just the U.S., this our numbers are 14,000 and 7,000 for tigers.
That is a lot of tigers. And again, as you suggest, kind of that as careful and sure accurate as your research is, it sounds like you're still kind of saying, like, that's the number we're comfortable saying. But the implication is that because there's probably other tigers stashed here and there that just people wouldn't know about, the number probably is even greater still.
We think it is, and tigers are sort of way off the grid and you know, in remote parts of Texas or northern Wisconsin. There's not really any true way to know it because there's no registration requirement.
Sure.
And there's no laws against breeding. So people breed them, and they breed them all the time. So that's why we think the number is more than that. We've heard numbers just for tigers as high as 12, but we're trying to be sort of realistic about it, and those are the categories we use, and it pretty much tracks to our experience.
So, Bill, I guess then the next kind of key question is, how did we get here? How did we get to where there's some 7,000 tigers in those various places that you described, and what are sort of some of the financial or business enterprises that are behind those numbers?
We think one of the drivers for that, Duncan, is the breeding. And the breeding started actually in 1963. A little bit of research we have on that is that a white tiger was imported into this country. I don't want to say as a stunt, but as a gift to the U.S. government by a guy by the name of John Kluge, well-intentioned. And he bought it in India and brought it in, put it in the National Zoo. It made the tour of the country and before your time. And it was quite popular, and then it became a popular animal in zoos, and so the tiger was returned to the National Zoo, was loaned to the Cincinnati Zoo, and the Cincinnati Zoo started a breeding program to breed tigers. And then once people discovered how easy it was to breed a tiger, just sort of put two tigers in a room, and all of a sudden, 109 days later, you have a litter, and then you keep doing that. You breed a lot of tigers, and then especially if you can breed a white one, it's very, very popular at zoos, and that's when it began to take off. And on a parallel thread, Siegfried and Roy, nice guys, they're still alive. They started their Tiger Act in Las Vegas, and that was a very interesting time for Las Vegas when it was trying to transform itself from sort of a gambling center into a family entertainment center. And they had the perfect show, you know, sort of a magic act with tigers. And we looked up the stats for them, and they performed in front of 10 million people for, you know, the better part of 40 years. So there's a whole generation of us out there that sort of think it's okay to have a tiger on a leash and, you know, that we can handle it. So that whole popularity thing is what drove the demand. And then because there's no restrictions on breeding, you can be a, what they call them, a backyard breeder and just breed tigers and then sell them into the market.
Yeah, so there does seem like a lot of factors there, including the Siegfried and Roy thing is beyond just that they're the sheer numbers, which are staggering, really, that that many people saw Siegfried and Roy. But within that, it seems like there's a whole other issue that is problematic, too, which is breeding tigers specifically to look a certain way. Siegfried and Roy are sort of famous for the white tigers in their act, but there's a lot of breeding and genetic and other difficulties that go with all the attempts to get those kind of tigers.
Oh, very much so. White tiger, although most people, including us, thought white tiger was its own species. It's not. It's just a Bengal or a Siberian with a what's called a double recessive gene, and that makes its coat white. But it's not its own species, as most people believe. And they're and in order to breed that, you have to keep inbreeding, you know, mother to son and father to daughter and all of that inbreeding, which makes the tiger really frail. And most of the product of that is orange tigers. So even though the breeders want to breed the whites in order to sell the whites, because the white cubs will sell to up to $30,000 per cub, and, you know, the orange ones will only sell for $1,000. So there's lots and lots of orange tigers that didn't turn out to be the right color, and they pretty much don't have a home, because there's not really a whole lot of demand for them. There's demand when they're cubs, but after they're cubs, after they're 3 or 4 months old, then they become just a very big cat, which is very dangerous and expensive to feed. So that's when the whole dumping thing comes in. That's the primary driver, is driving for the whites and then getting all the orange cubs, orange tigers, and then having no place for them to go.
Yeah, it seems like there's really, the more you talk here, Bill, there's really clearly a confluence of so many factors that are feeding this population of that we're now putting it at 7,000 or so, including that for all the efforts to, as you've noted, breed the white tigers, many of which are unsuccessful, so then there's that many more oranges. But still, they're cubs, and maybe we should get into, in a moment or two at least, just the whole other business, people who make their living essentially offering you a chance to have your picture taken with cubs, pet cubs, swim with cubs. So even if you're not necessarily trying to breed whites or breed a certain kind of tiger, it seems like many people are just breeding tigers just so there's cubs to feed their business.
Yes, and that's one of the commercial drivers for that, is the fact that a cub, you know, if you breed a litter and the litters are between 3 and 4 and you can, you know, you have 2 breeding tigers and you come out with 3 or 4 cubs and each are worth $1,000. And what the tigers in the wild breed every 3 years, because that's how long it takes the mother to train the cub to hunt. But in captivity, they'll breed them 3 times a year. So you'll get a breeding pair to give you 10 or 12 cubs, the breeders will just sell them to what are called the cub petters, and you just get a couple cubs and you put them in a dog carriers, put them in the back of a truck and drive them from wall to mall and set up to have your photo taken. It's really, really attractive for somebody who doesn't know anything about their origins and is just out for the day. Doesn't have to be a mall, could be the parking lot of a Burger King, and yeah. They usually pick on couples, and they'll take a cub and put it in the hands of the girl and say, you know, why don't you have your boyfriend take a picture, and then do the reverse, and why don't you take a picture, and it's not like it used to be, Duncan, you know, maybe, you know, 15 years ago, where you had to, you know, set up a tent and then have a picture and then have it developed and have come back for it. Now every, as you know, every phone is a camera, so they just drag them out, put them in your lap, and, you know, you take a picture and put it on Facebook.
Absolutely. Well, let me quickly let folks know who might be just tuning in. My guest is William Nimmo, founder of Tigers in America. We're talking mostly about captive-bred tigers. If you'd like to ask Bill a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So, yeah, so Bill, I mean, part of the thing that, what you're describing there, because you talked about how if you maybe unsuccessfully are trying to breed a white tiger and you get the orange instead, that could yield $1,000. But can you talk a little bit about what the money is, or what the money that can be made just in the situation you've described about at the mall or at the parking lot of Burger King, where people can get their picture taken or pet a tiger? Because it just seems like, at least in many of those cases, the money that people can make in a given day even is pretty mind-blowing.
Yeah, it does get the numbers get up there, and the sort of the tiger petting business, as I mentioned, can go anywhere from, and they usually get them in pairs in case one dies, anywhere from 2 to 4. We've seen traveling cub petting shows with up to 10 or 20. They set up in the mall, and some of them brag that, you know, they can make $10,000 a day. I don't know if that's true, but the generally accepted revenue from that is over $100,000 a year, perhaps $200,000 from somebody who wants to work the season, right? You get the cubs. The breeders take the cubs from their mothers when they're 2 days old. They can't even see. They bottle feed them, so they're now reliant on humans to be fed, and then they put them in the cages and drag them around. Now, they can do that for 8 weeks or 2 months, up until about 5 months, and usually they work the circuit south to north, starting in Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Florida, and then they wind up at the end of the season up in North Dakota or Wisconsin. And by that time, they don't want the tiger, and they are finished for their season, and they're going to drive back south. And that's when bad things happen, and tigers are released. Or actually, what they try and do, Duncan, is they try and sell them to somebody who is attracted to them. And the selling process is pretty straightforward. You know, it's been hand raised, and you know, its wild instincts are bred out of them. And you know, just take it home. I mean, your son or your daughter seems to really like it. It's just a big house cat. You just have to build an enclosure in the back. And you know, it's sort of an easy sell when the tiger is 4 months old. But when the tiger is 3 years old and weighs 500 pounds and is a danger to your children, the neighbors, everything else, the enclosures have to be stronger. They need a specific diet. Tiger eats 3% of its body weight every day, so it's 15 pounds of meat. It does get up there in terms of expense, and then they're sort of stuck, you know?
Yeah.
Well-intentioned people that wanted to do something nice for the kids, and it was a little exotic, and now they have the tiger. And generally what happens is they wind up giving him or dumping him, because they can't sell him at that point, to a roadside zoo. So any of these sort of non-accredited zoos that you'll see on, you know, on some side road on the way to the airport or on the way out of town and come in and see the tigers, those roadside zoos are pretty much the dumping ground of the cats.
So it really sounds like there are not only the numbers are huge and constantly replenishing, but that there's also multiple places along that given tiger's lifetime where he or she will be handed off or dumped, whether it's just post cub, you know, in the season, or people who, as you say, take it off those operators' hands and then later realize, hey, we can't keep this tiger here. And then,
yeah, I would say the high percentage of people just are well-intentioned, would wanted to care for the tiger. It is sort of exotic, whether or not it's ego-driven or not. They generally care for the animal, and it just gets out of control for them. And the other variation on that is if the tiger gets sick, right? They don't know what to do with a sick tiger. I mean, you can't call your vet and come over and say, you know, my son was trying to play with the tiger and it ate a stuffed animal and now it's choking to death.
Yeah.
You can't call the local vet and say, can you come over and examine my 500-pound tiger? They don't do that. So, unfortunately, a lot of tigers die from that, and tigers will die from when they realize it's you know, that amount of protein it needs every day, and they're not going to buy, you know, some food source that comes from Kansas or one of the great food suppliers that supplies the zoos. They wind up, in some cases, feeding them with roadkill and garbage and hope it's okay. And then there is no vet care, so it's not a friendly life for a tiger in that situation, and most of them don't make it. So there are cases, Duncan, where people get frustrated and actually shoot the tiger, and we had occasion to have that be very close to happen 6 weeks ago when people in Missouri said, I've just had it, I can't do anything else about it. I'm sorry, Alabama. And they said, I'm sorry, Bill, if you can't pick up these two tigers by Tuesday, we really have to shoot them. And we were sort of stunned with that. And we said, well, what about the, you know, what about fishing game? What about the Alabama or whatever? And then they were pretty candid about it. And they said, Bill, there's no laws in Alabama. Tigers are property. If we want to kill them, we'll kill them. Now, I don't know how much of that was dramatic in order for us to accelerate the rescue, but we actually did get them out, and Duncan, it does have a happy ending, and we relocated them into Carolina Tiger Rescue. But those conversations do happen, and people feel that the tiger is a piece of property and they can do with it what they want.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because to me, I mean, I'm just curious, both short-term and long-term, what can truly be done about the kind of scenarios you're describing, especially when in so many states, just as the people you just mentioned, they can kind of do what they want. It's just their property, and if they get exasperated or in over their head or it's too expensive or any number of other things, if they don't get the kind of action from you or other people that they need, yeah, I guess they could just go ahead and shoot their tigers.
Right. People like Humane Society US and IFAW, and there's other advocacy groups that we know about that are sort of on the advocacy part of that and trying to get the laws changed. The number of states that have no laws used to be about 9. Now it's down to just 5 states with no laws, the 2 Carolinas, Wisconsin, Nevada, and Alabama. And they're trying to get at least some laws in place to say you just can't kill the animal. Other than that, there's state laws that are trying to be toughened. But we're not that close to the advocacy thing. I know there's people that are doing that. We're pretty much on the back end of that, saying whatever your reason is that the tiger's at risk, if you give us a call and we have time, and we'll try and come and get him, and we relocate him to one of the what we call our sanctuaries, 13 sanctuaries.
So would you say then that is kind of the chief mission of tigers in America, although there's a number of other important issues that all kind of overlap here? Sounds like your chief focus is, when you can, to rescue those tigers and get them into sanctuaries that you think highly of.
That's exactly correct. I mean, there's other people that are doing it. There's people that have been involved in this. We've been only involved for 3 years. There's people who have been involved in this for 30 years and sort of understand the politics of it and the pressures that and who exerts them as to why something can or can't be done. But we're not credentialed to do that, and we don't understand a whole lot of that. But what we do understand is, if you have a tiger and there's no reason it has to have an unnatural death. There's no reason why it has to starve to death or has to die of a disease that could be fixed by a vet. I mean, that's really difficult for us to accept, and that's why we formed Tigers in America, and that's why we try and do the rescues and construct enclosures at the sanctuaries that we work with.
This is Talking Animals. I'm speaking with William Nimmo, founder of Tigers in America. We invite you to join the conversation. We have just a few more minutes left with Bill by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So, Bill, I have, a few questions then sort of related to the sanctuaries. One, someone who wrote in who wasn't sure they'd be able to send in a question during the show itself. But my question prior to that even is, maybe you could just talk a little bit about the best tiger sanctuaries and what the criteria is for you to determine that those are the top flight tiger sanctuaries.
Yes. It was a bit of a challenge. I mean, because there are... Quickly, Duncan, there's no law against there's no legal restrictions to use the word sanctuary. So if you wanted to have a corporation, you could say that you know this was Duncan's Tiger Sanctuary. You will not get challenged either on a corporate state level, or you will not get challenged if you file for a tax exempt status with the federal government. You can't call yourself a police station or a hospital or a church, but you can call yourself a sanctuary. So there's a lot of people that are not sanctuaries, you know, breeders, dealers, cub petters, roadside zoos, that will call themselves sanctuaries. So the list we got back had 130 that were listed, and with a lot of research by people that we trust, we narrowed that down to 30, and then we had another set of criteria that we went through to determine which sanctuaries we should visit. He said, if you had 10 rescued tigers, and if you had 20 acres that was in the name of the sanctuary, and if you had infrastructure, and by infrastructure we mean you had a paid staff, you had a volunteer system, you had an intern system, you had a food source, you had a water source, you were sort of a going concern, and you had the experience with rescued tigers, then we would come and visit, which we did. And then we have a little questionnaire that talks about your financials, and at the end of this due diligence or interrogation, depending on your perspective, if it looked like you were doing the right thing with the cats and taking in cats and caring for them, and we would talk to not only the owners but the keepers and the board of directors, and if it looked good, then what we did was put them on our Tigers in America sanctuary list, and that's how we got to the 13.
I got you. Well, because one of the things that the woman I mentioned that wrote in yesterday, actually, just not sure that she could be part of the show, had some questions about some of the sanctuaries that particularly she felt like had huge sort of financial issues. Tiger Creek Wildlife Refuge in Texas, Tiger Haven in Tennessee, and just the amount of money that they take in relative to what goes to the actual programs. And so I don't probably have the time to go into all the detail that she provided here. But I guess her key question is sort of the reverse of what you just described, which is aside from identifying the best tiger sanctuaries in the country, do you enlighten people about the worst ones, or just leave the list of the best ones to kind of speak to the caliber of the rest of them?
B.
Okay. Yeah. If it's not on your list, then pretty much for one reason or another, that sanctuary is not up to the key standard.
Yes, and I'm familiar with those sanctuaries, and we visited 30 sanctuaries, and if it's not on the list, it means there's a problem. Yeah. And one of the problems could be that you raise a bunch of money and none of the money gets to the cats.
Right. Yeah, I mean, because it just seems like there's just this thing is rampant. I mean, just this morning, just to put on Facebook talking about our interview coming up, I saw that there was a photograph that had just been published of Beyonce and Jay-Z and their daughter there, Blue Ivy, petting and feeding a tiger cub. Now, this was, happened to be in Thailand, and I guess on a recent trip. But I guess part of the problem is high-profile celebrities can lead by example in either direction. So whether you know it's in Thailand or not, if you see that picture and you like Jay-Z or Beyonce or whatever, you think, hey, that looks cool. Maybe that's something that we should do next time that those people are coming through the mall or the Burger King parking lot or whatever the case may be. So
yeah, I mean, that's something that we have to deal with. We're not sort of in the celebrity business, but we know the power of celebrity. We know something like that. If somebody from the Detroit Tigers baseball team wants to get a pet tiger, it's just a terrible message to, 80,000 fans. But there's not too much we can do about that, except when we get a question, say, it's we also dealt with the Mike Tyson tiger. His four tigers, there was another tiger that was rescued out of New York. I mean, we know where they came from, but we pretty much deal with the aftermath. And I think some of the sanctuaries, as they get more established and they get known, I think it may attract some sort of celebrity attention, which I think would be really good, and get the message out through that way. Like Yao Ming, the big basketball player, he's doing a whole lot with the wild animals and
elephants,
from a Chinese perspective. But I don't think we have a lot of celebrities that do that now. But hopefully, as the you know, as this movement grows, it will resonate. And as a, and just if I could just add one tagline, Duncan.
Sure.
It's a lot of the places that you go to that purport to be, you know, conservation and preservation and education, and you know, even though you can swim with tigers and walk your tiger and pet your tiger and blah blah blah, most of the people in this country, including myself, we didn't know that all of the breeding and all of the education, conservation, preservation story is not true. In the 50 years, and we don't know how many tigers have been bred, but it's in the tens of thousands, not one of these tigers has been introduced into the wild.
You're preaching the converted there, Bill, because one of the pet peeves I've had, and we talked a lot about on the show, is that, generally speaking, conservation is bandied about in all kinds of ways, but it's usually just complete baloney. And that's a perfect example, and all these other operations that say, oh, yeah, we have a big conservation program, but where's the actual conservation? It doesn't exist. So, yeah, I hear you on that. And yeah, as you mentioned, the thing about the Detroit Tigers, I should mention that one of our emailers earlier, when we were running down the various sources of tigers or where they exist, talked about, of course, that there are team mascots. LSU is the one that I think they mentioned. But, yeah, tigers are everywhere, but it sounds like you're really doing your share, and I should be sure to mention that the website is tigersinamerica.org, and there's a lot of really, not only, of course, the list of the approved sanctuaries, but a lot of good research, videos, information to learn a lot more about the situation and to help out in whatever way you can, including writing local legislators to see if we can tighten up a lot of these laws.
Yeah. Thank you, Duncan. And if any of your listeners are interested in going to that site, on that site you'll see a map of the United States with the 13 tiger sanctuaries that are starred. And I know you have a reach beyond Tampa, so if any of your listeners are near any of those sanctuaries, I would just encourage you to go and see their work and see them and talk to them and see the cats and see what they do for them.
Absolutely,
it is remarkable stuff. They've dedicated their lives to this, and that's why we help them.
For sure, and as you noted earlier in the interview, one of those 13 designated is just down the road a piece at Big Cat Rescue right here in Tampa. So
they are probably one of the best, and they were the ones I think I mentioned. They were the ones that took the first three tigers we ever rescued. Our rescue count is now up to 88 tigers.
Wow, that is so great. Well, again, we've been speaking with Bill Nimmo of Tigers in America. One more time, the website is tigersinamerica.org. Bill, thanks so much for making the time to join us today on Talk Animals and for all your great work helping all these tigers.
Thanks very much for the interest, Duncan. We really appreciate it.
All right, take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
All right, in a moment, we'll have a brief chat with Gracie Grishup of Pet Pal Animal Shelter to outline the PIT project they initiated with the ultimate aim of cultivating more adoptions of pit bulls. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. She's become one of our favorites. This is Erin Foley with a piece called Dogs on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I'm thinking about getting a dog. Dog people, clap. Yeah? People love the dogs. I love the dog. I've never had a dog. It would be super exciting to get a dog. Not, and funny. Hilarious. I don't know what kind of dog I want to get. It just seems like when I look around, there's a lot of aggressive crossbreeding going on with dogs these days. It's weird. I don't even know what I'm looking at anymore. Like, you used to be able to look at a dog and be like, that's a lab. That's a golden retriever. Now you look at a dog and you're like, what the hell is that? It's like a face of like a Doberman. Like a shepherd body. But it's so tiny. It's such a tiny dog. And I'm always like, excuse me, what kind of dog do you have? And they're like, it's a German Doberoodle. Yes, yes, yes. I don't know why I didn't go with German Doberoodle. Yes. I was going to go with creepy, because it's a creepy dog. You're creepy, and the whole situation's creepy. I kind of want to, like, push the envelope with the dog owners. You know what I mean? What I want to do is I want to rent a Shetland pony and take it into the dog park. Just to see the look of the dog owner's faces and be like, excuse me, what kind of dog is that? It's like a mutt. I don't know. It's like part mastiff, Great Dane, hyena, collie mix. Something like that. Wow, it just really looks like a Shetland pony. I know. We get that all the time. It's uncanny. absolutely uncanny, but it's such a great dog. I mean, I haven't even heard it bark. It's just quiet, quiet dog. And then I'm going to jump on top of it and ride it out of the park.
That was Aaron Foley with a piece called Dogs, taken from her album Lower the Bar. Right now, from Pet Pal Animal Shelter, tell us a little bit about their pet project. Let's welcome Gracie Grisha back to Talk Animals. Good morning, Gracie.
Good morning, Duncan.
Nice to have you back again on Talk Animals. Of course, we have talked a few times about Pet Pal, but maybe just give us a quick overview of what it is and what it does, and then we'll talk more specifically for a moment or two about the pet project.
You got it. I'll be as short and brief and to the point as possible, but and if any of your listeners want to go, if they're at home or at work, online to our website, and they can maybe follow along in more detail about what the Pit Project is and about Pet Pal Animal Shelter, just visit petpalanimalshelter.com. And then go to our donate page, and right underneath the donate page, if you scroll down, there's the whole description of what the Pit Project is. I really wish I could get more into detail and follow up more with Williams. Talking about the tigers, because really we're kind of in a similar situation with animals. There's just too many animals that don't have homes. And the majority of them that you see in a lot of the shelters across the United States are pit bull breeds. So they just end up in the wrong places. They're really cute and fluffy and fun when they're little. And everybody thinks they're adorable, but they're actually really tenacious and strong and very loyal, and they just need to be in the right hands. So that's really what the Pit Project's mission is and goal is, to get these breeds into the proper home.
So how does that work exactly? It sounds like there's a bit of a sort of educational initiative as part of this sort of stepped-up effort to adopt out more pit bulls.
Absolutely. Well, we work with the pit bulls that come in. From the get-go, when they come into our shelter, we make sure that we do a behavioral assessment, check them out for any health issues. Most likely they're going to be heartworm positive. It's just one of the things, or have some kind of skin issue. We treat all of those things as a no-kill shelter. We get them all up to par, get them healthy, and then also do some more training with the owner. They can come in, we have work with a couple other dog handlers and dog trainers, they can come in and we kind of work around with them. They can spend some time with the dog, maybe walk them properly, even just the basic commands, just, you know, having that ownership of I'm stronger than you, basically. You can't dominate me. I'm going to be the owner of you, and you're going to be my best friend, but you're going to be in a really healthy and loving environment. And we're going to be loyal to each other. That's really the way that we want to handle that situation. There's also the whole education with heartworms, sleep prevention. All of those things come in. And basically with the Pit Project, once they find that, you know, we have the proper fit for an owner with a pit bull or a mixed pity breed, the owners go home with a crate. We encourage crate training. So don't tear up your home and go back to a kill shelter where we all started off. They go home with a crate. They go home with plenty of toys, Kong toys. They go home with heartworm prevention for a month. We really push that, especially in Florida, to state birds. Sleep prevention. And they go home with a bag of food, get them started. We have a vet visit at our clinic, Pet Pal Veterinary Clinic. So we really want to push the whole process of 100%. I'm in this for the long haul, hopefully, you know, 15, 20 years, whatever age that this beautiful animal lives to be with me.
That's cool. Well, Gracie, I'm afraid we're out of time, but let me give the website one more time for people to follow up. It's petpalanimalshelter.com. And again, the program we've been speaking about specifically is called The Pit Project. So, Gracie, thanks for joining us again and filling us in. It sounds like a great project, and let's hope that more pits find home as a result.
Thank you so much, Duncan.
Thanks, Gracie. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals. The show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to Name That Animal Tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WMNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a copy of Talking Animals Anniversary Bash CD to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this tiger-related animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. We'll take those guesses off the air. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, January 14th, when my guest will be John W. James, co-author of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss, having founded the Grief Recovery Institute some 30-plus years ago. James and his colleagues are offering their expertise to the estimated 50 to 60 million of people grieving the death of a pet each year. So I hope you'll join me for that next Wednesday on Talking Animals. It's WMNF Tampa, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond. We'll catch you next Wednesday.